Lecture 6, The Path to Nirvana.
In our last lecture, we talked about the first of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, and we had a long discussion of that important and problematic Buddhist concept of no-self. The point of that discussion, as you recall, was to explore one of the basic dilemmas in the Buddhist tradition, to try to understand how they can make such an apparently pessimistic claim about the nature of life and experience it as being an experience of freedom, of lightness, of a sense of buoyancy, and detachment from the difficulties of this world. Our job in this lecture is to continue the discussion of the Four Noble Truths, to talk about the second, the third, and the fourth, and to get a sense then of the full picture of the Buddhist analysis of the nature of life and the nature of the world. The second noble truth is called the truth of the arising of suffering. According to this noble truth, the origin of suffering, the arising of suffering, is explained by a causal sequence known as the 12-fold chain of dependent arising. And the word dependent arising is probably the longest of the technical terms that we use in an introductory course on Buddhism. In Pali, it is paticca samuppada. It's not really necessary to remember, but it's an important technical term for the discussion of Buddhism, especially when you begin to talk about the philosophers. So suffering comes from a 12-fold process of dependent conditioning, dependent arising. We could spend a little time, if we wanted, talking about each of the 12 links in the chain. That's quite a possible way to look into this concept. It's not terribly productive, in part, I think, because the 12 links of the chain represent the merging of a couple of different causal analyses of human life and human experience. So it's better for us at the beginning, really, to pluck two or three crucial links out of the chain just to see how the chain works. And if we do that, we see suffering as arising essentially from ignorance, from an experience of ignorance about the world. And from that ignorance comes desire or craving. And then out of desire or craving, according to this causal formula, comes birth. So ignorance leads to desire. Desire leads to birth. This might seem counterintuitive at first, but it's not difficult to understand. To understand what Buddhists have in mind when they say this, you might simply, probably a pretty easy thing to do, take a glossy advertisement from a magazine. I don't happen to have one here, but I suppose I could have stuffed one in my back pocket and brought it with me. Just take a glossy advertisement from a magazine, or imagine one being shown on the TV, or simply drive down some great strip in contemporary America and look at all of the advertising images that are presented to us on the roadside, and ask what kind of illusion that advertisement is meant to foster, what kinds of desires it's meant to arouse, and what comes into being as a result of those desires. Now, most of the desires are pretty benign, of course. We're not talking about anything that's really deeply troubling or problematic here, but they feed the creative process, that process of constantly acquiring new things and letting them slip away and getting more things that, from a Buddhist point of view, would feed the process of death and rebirth. It simply fuels samsara. This is the fire that's added to the fuel that's added to the fire of the personality and the fire of experience that drives this continuous process of death and rebirth. Now, the most fundamental form of ignorance, obviously, especially after what we talked about last time, is the idea that I, this something here, this personality, am something permanent that needs to be protected and fed with desirable experiences and ever more desirable objects. That's the basic form of ignorance that fuels this fire of existence. Now, obviously, if you simply focus on these three links, the link that leads from ignorance to desire to birth, you've got implicitly a roadmap of how you can reverse the process. If what you want to do is stop rebirth, as Buddhists do in this traditional teaching, if you want to stop rebirth, then what you do is remove ignorance. Somehow chip away at that basic misconception that people have about the world, and as a result, diminish desire. Slowly let some of those desires begin to slip away, and as a result of that, the process of birth will begin to unravel. It may not happen quickly. It may not even happen in this lifetime. In fact, very likely, according to this traditional view, it won't happen in this lifetime, but you can at least begin to set the process moving in a more positive direction. And if you do that, eventually what happens is you become... you find yourself on the path to nirvana. It's nirvana that is the third noble truth, the definitive cessation of suffering. The Pali word for nirvana is one that I've already mentioned to you. It's nibbana. Now, what do we mean then by nirvana? What is this concept? It's talked about a lot, you know. It really is a part of our vocabulary in this country. You can speak about all sorts of things as being like nirvana. And generally, they're quite positive, quite pleasurable. What would it be? I went down to Fenway Park the other day, and I saw Nomar Garciaparra hit a Grand Slam home run. And boy, for a moment, I felt like I was in nirvana. Turned out I was only in Fenway Park, but I felt like I was in nirvana, something exquisitely pleasurable. That's, I suspect, you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I suspect that that's the popular view of this idea of nirvana. Truth is, of course, it's not positive in quite that obvious a way. Actually, if you think about the meaning of the word, the etymology of the word itself, it's quite a negative concept. Nirvana means literally to blow out, to extinguish the flame of a candle. So nirvana, you might say, is cessation. It's extinction in the sense of the extinguishing of a fire that burns constantly from one life to the next. And it's important to realize, I think, I'm convinced of this, to realize at the very beginning, when you think about nirvana, that it is a hard image, and in many respects, quite a cold image. So the comparison that I use when I talk to students about this comes from an experience that I had actually, I guess now, quite a while ago, when I was visiting in Rome. During a spring vacation once, I went down to a great Roman church. On the Thursday night before Easter for the service of Tenebrae, where the lights inside the church were extinguished. I'd have to say that that experience, I can actually almost feel the hair stand up on the back of my neck now as I recall myself in that place. We were in this great dark church. It was nighttime. It was early in the spring, and there was a line of Italian choir boys walking out of the service when the service was over, and each one was carrying a big candle. And as they walked down the aisle, each one blew out the candle in turn, one after another. And when that last candle went out, bang, the church was plunged into darkness, and then everyone filed out of the church in silence. It was quiet. It was dark. It was deeply moving. That's not unlike nirvana. Nirvana is the extinction of the flame of desire, the flame of existence. So it is like that moment of extinguishing in the experience of that service. Now, for us to understand the technical concept, to dig more deeply into what's going on here, we have to understand that nirvana really comes at two moments in the Buddha's life. It comes first in the moment of his awakening, when he realizes, I suppose you'd have to say, that he's not laying any more fuel onto the fire. That's a first moment, you might say, of extinguishing. It's the first time when he realizes that the fire will eventually go out. So at the moment of his awakening, he understands so thoroughly what the causes are of the process of death and rebirth that he knows that he's not fueling it anymore. That's nirvana number one. It's called nirvana with residues because there still is karma from past lives that needs to be worked out. And then eventually, about 40 years or so later, at the end of his life, he has the experience of parinirvana, of complete extinction, when all of it burns out. And the Buddha is released completely from the cycle of death and rebirth. These two moments, then, are called nirvana with residues and nirvana without residues. Nirvana without residues also is sometimes called parinirvana, the Buddha's complete extinction. Now, we face here with the concept of nirvana a dilemma that's fairly similar to the dilemma we faced earlier with the concept of suffering. Nirvana is spoken of in the Buddhist tradition as being extremely desirable, something that we would really like to seek. And yet we have to confront it, I think, initially as being a rather harsh concept, a concept that has to do with the extinction of things that for many of us, at least, are pretty desirable, pretty positive in our normal understanding of human life. So we have to ask ourselves this basic question, you know, why do Buddhists treat this as being such a desirable goal? What's so great about this? Why would you ever want to seek nirvana if it involves the extinction of all of these things that to many of us are really quite desirable? The first answer to this question, I think, really has to be one in which we look very carefully again at the Indian assumption about the nature of reincarnation. I think the concept of nirvana forces us really to take quite seriously, in a way that we may not even have done initially, the negative aspect and the negative evaluation of the concept of reincarnation in this Indian tradition. If reincarnation is something you don't want, if you really don't want to come back again and again in some future life, then really what you want to do, what you seek, is the stopping of that. And the Buddha, bless his wonderful heart, the Buddha found how to do that. That was the great thing that he discovered. So that if samsara is something you want to escape, the Buddha showed the way. He found how to do it and found how to stop it. So nirvana is negative in an appropriate way in the Indian tradition, because samsara is something that you would like to avoid and you would like to escape. Now, I think it's interesting when you approach nirvana this way to think a little bit about how the concept of nirvana compares to concepts of the ultimate goal of human life that might be closer to home. For many of you who are Jewish or Christian, you have in your minds, I suspect, an image of God, of that image that Jewish and Christian people make of ultimate reality, at some point in the mythic past, looking at the chaos of creation, looking in a certain sense at nothing, and making something come into existence. Christian doctrine of creation is called creatio ex nihilo, creation from nothing. So God looked at nothing and made something come into being. And I think it's fair to say that for Christian people, and this would be true for Jewish people as well, and probably true for Muslims, although I don't know the tradition as well as I know those other two, that when you wake up in the morning, what you imagine you're doing is something that is essentially creative. You look at the chaos of the day, the nothing that the world presents you with, this blank slate of a day, and you try to make something beautiful come into existence. Creativity is something that we strongly value. We search for being. We search to bring new things into existence. It's really fascinating to think that the Buddhist tradition is almost exactly the opposite. The Buddha faced a situation in his own life in which things had been going on from beginningless time In the Buddhist tradition, there really is no time when creation began. It's just always been there. They speak often of beginningless ignorance, of the beginningless flow of human existence, beginningless samsara. And the Buddha understood how to stop one piece of it. He discovered how to do that. He brought one piece of it to an end. So what he teaches us, interestingly, I'm really fascinated by this, is that when we wake up in the morning, when we begin a day, or when we experience the flow of experience from one moment to the next, the challenge is not to take that and busily create something new out of it, but to allow it to quiet, to allow some of it to slip away. That's not nirvana, but it's a pretty good analogy of nirvana, to take this busy flow of experience and let some of it become quiet. That's what the Buddha discovered how to do, and that's what the Buddha teaches to his followers, particularly in this concept of nirvana. In some respects, diametrically opposed to the image of human life that grows out of some of the theistic traditions of the West, and yet it serves, in my opinion, as a remarkable counterpoint and supplement and challenge, really, to the approach that many of us bring to the experiences of our ordinary, everyday lives. So the first way to answer the question about why Buddhists would seek nirvana is to recognize quite seriously that samsara is a problem that needs to be solved. And it's solved by allowing the busy flow of experience in some way to become quiet and come to an end. But it seems to me, as with the concept of suffering, that this isn't the whole story. It's not the whole picture, in truth. Because nirvana wasn't just the moment of death for the Buddha. It wasn't his parinirvana. It was also that moment of his awakening that took place when he was a young man, and he realized that at that point he was free from all the ignorance that drove the cycle of transmigration. And then he lived for 40 years. A long, productive, eloquent, spontaneous life, free life, moving through the roads of northern India, reacting to the experiences of people around him, teaching them the Dharma, begging his food, building a community of disciples and followers, and setting in motion this remarkable religious tradition that we're studying together. So if you want to understand what's positive about nirvana, I think the most important thing to do is try to imagine as well as we can, and we have just really fragmentary indications of what this person was like, but try to imagine as well as we can what he was like, what that Buddha was like as he glided through the landscape of northern India for 40 years after his awakening. What kinds of words would we put on that? Well, I think we have to say, using the language of the Indian tradition, that he was exquisitely free, first of all. He was free from desire, he was free from ignorance, and there was nothing in that sense that troubled him or disturbed his heart. And as a result of that, he was able to respond freely to the interests and the needs of people around him. That story that I told you when we were talking about the life story of the Buddha, about Angulimala, that strange Buddhist mass murderer who strung a string of fingers around his neck, shows a remarkable image of the Buddha himself, really, as a teacher, as somebody who was able to respond to the distinctive needs of a person who would, for other people, be extraordinarily frightening, and to touch his heart and to convert him to a different way of understanding himself and the nature of the world. So he is free. He's unattached. He's able to touch people in a certain kind of powerful and distinctive way. I think you would also have to say that he's wise. He understands what the world brings. There's nothing that's going to shake him in that in that sense. So we can speak about the Buddha as being wise, as being unattached, as being free, and able to act with a certain spontaneity and clarity of mind in his relationship to others. And also, I think it's appropriate to say that he embodies a certain quality of compassion as well, a certain kind of compassionate ability to respond to other people's needs, although the concept of compassion is not one that we begin to speak of in a technical sense until we come to the Mahayana. It would be extremely unwise, I think, to imagine that this Buddha was so rarefied and so detached from the experience of suffering in the ordinary world that he could not respond to the suffering in other people. That's what we mean, really, by compassion in the Buddhist tradition. So you can see here that nirvana, and it's important for us to understand nirvana as a negative idea. In understanding it as a negative idea, we understand it in its Indian way, as a concept that responds to the particular challenges and needs of Indian civilization. But it's not a negative concept, as it were, in its totality. It is negative in form, you might say, but positive in content. The experience that you have of nirvana is an experience of freedom, of unattached, of detachment, of wisdom, and the ability to respond with a certain clarity of mind to all the difficulties that life presents you. And in that sense, I think you can really imagine that it is the Buddhist image of the perfection of a human person, because that really is what the Buddha is for Buddhists. He is a perfect human being. That's the third noble truth, the truth of cessation, the truth of nirvana. There also is a fourth noble truth, the path to nirvana, that we should discuss. Obviously, it's important for us to know something about the discipline that leads people to nirvana, both for lay people and also for the monks and nuns who are part of the Buddhist monastic community. Now, the path to nirvana is often divided into eight categories, like the eight spokes of the wheel of the Buddha's teaching, the Noble Eightfold Path, beginning with a concept of right understanding and then moving on through right thought, right speech, right action, and so on, right livelihood. You can imagine what some of these are. I think that the logic of the path becomes a little bit more clear if we take these eight categories and reduce them or group them together into three. This is often done in traditional Buddhist teaching: sila, or moral conduct; samadhi, mental concentration; and punya, or wisdom. So if you ask, especially as we confront this tradition for the first time, what does a Buddhist have to do to achieve nirvana? Okay, professor, you've been telling me about nirvana. I'm convinced that it might be something worth trying. What would I have to do if I wanted to seek that great ideal? Well, first of all, you should abide by certain basic rules of moral conduct. You know why? Because if you perform actions that are going to be dangerous and destructive for other people or for yourself, you may very well end up coming back like one of those tigers or worms or boars or ants or mosquitoes that we talked about when we were reading the Upanishads. And it's not all that easy, if you're a mosquito, to try to achieve nirvana. So it would be a good idea for you at least to start by engaging in the proper modes of conduct that will make it possible for you to come back in a way that would be conducive to nirvana. What are those? No killing. No stealing. No lying, no abuse of sex, and no drinking intoxicants. The five basic moral precepts of the traditional practice of Buddhism. These apply to lay people as well as to monks, something that anyone can do. Monks observe five more basic precepts and a number of other regulations that also have to do specifically with the monastic life. These include the restriction that they cannot eat after 12 noon, so all monks beg their food in the morning and have, let's say, a sufficient meal before noon. I'm tempted to say that they have a big meal, but I don't know the monks in the Theravada tradition well enough to say that they really sit down with a full begging bowl and absolutely fill their stomachs, but they have to provide for themselves a sufficient meal by noontime and then not eat for the rest of the day. None of this food, of course, can be carried over to the next day, so they have to beg each day the food for that day. They're not supposed to sleep on soft beds, and they can't handle gold or silver. So in a monastery, if the monastery has financial dealings that need to be taken care of, they have to have a layperson who will take care of their accounts and engage in the purchases that keep the monastic life in motion. The prohibition against sleeping on soft beds is an amusing one. It reminds me of an experience I once had when I was in the Center for World Religions at Harvard, which also was what we sometimes call a laboratory of interreligious dialogue, as well as a place for scholars to come and study other religious traditions. There was quite a noted monk from Thailand who came to visit us one time, and in this rather austere place, we thought we had what I considered, at least at the time, to be not very soft beds. In truth, they were pieces of foam rubber over what seemed like a chain link bed frame. And this monk came in, looked at that foam rubber, and thought, phew, no way can I sleep on such a padded mattress. And he took the foam rubber off and leaned it up against the wall and slept right on the chain link bed frame. I was a little surprised, but I suppose I shouldn't have been if I had been reading the stipulations of the monastic code. In any case, the monks observe these five additional precepts in addition to the five precepts of an ordinary layperson. And in the process, of course, set the stage through a certain kind of karmic preparation for the process that will lead eventually to nirvana. Another thing that Buddhist practitioners do, of course, is to engage in mental concentration. The term here is samadhi, to concentrate the mind. Most of you think, I suspect, if you think about Buddhist practice, that meditation is really the most fundamental thing that Buddhists do, and that's certainly true in many parts of the Buddhist tradition. You might even begin yourselves to imagine what meditation might be like. It's not impossible to do it even in very ordinary situations in life. What you try to do is to situate yourself very stably, to sit in a chair. You could probably even do it standing if you could be stable. Keep your back straight. The Dalai Lama insists on this when he teaches meditation, and it's important to do it because it allows you to breathe freely. It allows your diaphragm to be free. And then you might want to fold your hands in front of you in this particular gesture. This is one of the simplest, with your one palm laying on another and your thumbs just touching. Lay your hands in your lap, and then just breathe. Concentrate your attention as much as you can on that place in the pit of your stomach where your breathing centers, and allow your body and your mind to become calm. One of my old yoga teachers in India once used to say that in an experience of samadhi like this, you allow the thoughts in your head to simply drain out of your mind as if they were dirty water out of a bathtub. And in a way, that's what it is. It's allowing the mind to become calm and allowing the thoughts to clarify themselves by allowing all of this buzzy activity of the in the brain just simply to stop. You could imagine, I suppose, that this discipline of mental concentration is a way of doing for the mind what the discipline of moral conduct does for the body. It's a way to stop all of those distractions, all of those negative tendencies that tie you to the experience of death and rebirth. So this form of meditation, of mental concentration, of calming the mind by focusing on the breath, is one of the most basic forms of Buddhist discipline. It's found in the early scriptures, found in the early records of the Buddhist community, and then it, of course, continues on in practice among Buddhists today. Finally, the third thing that you want to do, and in a lot of ways this is the most important because it really is the foundation of all other Buddhist virtues, is to cultivate wisdom. Here the word is punya. It actually comes from the great Sanskrit root gna, J-N-A, which is cognate with our knowledge, with the kano of knowledge. So punya, is in a sense prognosis, to know the nature of the world and to know where it's going, so that you yourself can become detached from it and begin the process that leads to nirvana. What do you know? Of course, particularly the reality of no self. So it's these three things, sila, samadhi, and punya, that lead you eventually to the experience of nirvana.